Welcome to The Gladiator Way. I'm your host, Dan Nitro Clark. On The Gladiator Way, we bring you conversations with amazing people who share their gladiator stories, and they teach us how they committed, crushed, and conquered their life situations and came out on top. I believe every journey has a lesson, and by us sharing these lessons with you, it's going to teach you how to live the gladiator way so you can conquer the things that stand in your way, no matter how big or small. On this week's episode, I have best-selling author Dan Millman. He's the author of 17 books, including one of my favorite of all time, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. When I first started The Gladiator Way, I had a vision for the type of guests I wanted on the show. Dan Millman is one of those guests. He has been a mentor for me for years. His books helped shape me as a young man, and he is one of the spiritual giants in our world today. In this episode, we talk about how to live the way of the peaceful warrior. How do you take that warrior spirit and put it together with the Eastern philosophy to have some peace? His book, The Way of Peaceful Warrior, was turned into a movie with Nick Nolte and has been adapted in 29 languages. He is one of the standout authors and spiritual giants in our world today, and currently he travels the world speaking. And he's also been a highly sought after coach for decades. What Dan's book did for me, it helped give me a bridge from athletics and achievement-based satisfaction and fulfillment to finding something deeper. Because no matter how much success I had, I still felt like there was something missing inside of me, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. His book, The Peaceful Warrior, and the following books after that really helped me on my journey. So sit back, relax, get ready for a treasure trove of wisdom in this episode from Dan Millman. And remember, if you do like this episode, always go share with a friend and subscribe to The Gladiator Way. And if you want to reach out to me, you want to find me, you want to hook up, you want to connect with me, you want to see what's going on with me and Ricky. Ricky's now a year and a few months old, and see all the wonderful things I'm doing and crazy things I'm doing. You can always find me on social media at Dan Nitro Clark on Facebook and Dan Nitro Clark on Instagram. Now, let's get on to this awesome show with one of my mentors, someone I hope you'll find his books, go to his website and look him up, the one and only Dan Millman. Dan Millman, welcome to The Gladiator Way. I'm so excited to have you on, man. You don't know how pumped I am. You don't know how transformational your books were for me when I was a young man going from being a professional athlete to trying to find my way in life. So thank you so much for writing the Peaceful Warrior series. I'm so grateful for you.
Well, I'm always glad to hear good comments like that, Nitro. And it's good to be here with you today.
Yeah, and we're both named Dan, so I loved how in the pre-thing, can I just call you Nitro?
Right. Less awkward. Dan, you know.
Yeah. You know, when I first got done with American Gladiator, I was like, don't call me Nitro. My name is Dan. And then, you know, sure. 10 years later, 15 years later, 20 years later, right? I just had to accept what was.
Right. I don't know if Stallone likes being called Rocky either, but it happens.
Yeah, it happens. So, you know, for you, for me, the first book was The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. I found it so fascinating because the mental work that I had done was all about self-improvement, how to get better, how to be more productive, how to imagine your success. And for me, the distraction was athletics, was football. And there wasn't, no matter what I achieved in sports, there still wasn't that happiness inside. There was an emptiness inside. And Socrates, your journey with him helped me understand that at a different level. Now, here's a mistake I make, because I know your work so well. I assume everybody that is listening knows your work so well. So I want you to help me bring out the teachings in your work, the stuff that I know and I incorporate in my life. So people listening, gladiators who are working to commit, crush, conquer the obstacles that are standing in their way, can extract some of that. And I know the first thing would probably be me shutting up so you can talk. So tell me about the journey of Dan and Socrates and the lessons there that you hope people get.
Sure. when I was a young athlete and later a coach at Stanford University and a college professor teaching physical education, I was focused on how we can create more talent for sports, for physical training, whether martial arts, any kind of sport, dance, whatever. And it seemed to me, from my experience and observations, that talent was about 20% innate in terms of body type and so on. But you might agree in your experience that what we call talent can also be developed. If we define talent as the ability to learn faster and easier and rise to higher levels, raise our potential, then I ask myself, what qualities create talent for learning any sport and improving? And it seemed to me strength was obviously one of them, and suppleness, flexibility, range of motion, and also stamina and sensitivity. Things we don't often train, which is things like coordination, rhythm, timing, balance, reflex speed. So I began when the gymnast came to Stanford in the first year, instead of working on the gymnastics skills themselves, we focused on that foundation of talent. So they got very strong, supple, developed coordination, and so on. And the team went from the bottom of the conference when I started there to one of the top three teams in the United States, which they've been pretty much since then. This was many years ago, but I started that dynasty based on working on their talent level. But, you know, as I sometimes describe, being able to do somersaults and cartwheels and so on didn't help me much when I went out on a date, when I got married, or when I had kids, or when I dealt with financial challenges or career decisions. And so I started asking bigger questions, not how can we develop more talent for sports, but how can we develop more talent for living, for life's bigger picture, for the events and challenges we face in everyday life? So that question really sent me around the world studying with various mentors. I'm working on a book now, a memoir, maybe my last book, 18th book, about the process of how I evolved and how it reflects people's search, the bigger picture. So that eventually led me to an approach to living. After studying with many different people, my own expression, which I call the Peaceful Warrior's Way. And the Peaceful Warrior term came from my experience in martial arts. You know, I was teaching a course at Oberlin College in Ohio, and it was Aikido and Tai Chi and the basics of the martial arts. But these were internal arts, and I was going to call it the Way of the Warrior. But that didn't quite fit, so I said, wait a minute, maybe I'll call it the Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And that phrase, that's how it was born. And that's, I ended up titling my book, the best known one probably, which they turned into a movie, as you know.
With Nick Nolte, less.
Yeah, Way of the Peaceful Warrior. You actually resemble Nick a little bit, you know? Actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, I'm much old younger. I'm old and I'm haggard and I look like I've drank a lot, even though I haven't.
But he's a great guy. That's how it led me to this approach, this way of expressing. You know, I often remind people, Nitro, that I can only remind people of what they know at deeper levels, but we tend to forget. So I offer reminders, observations, and perspectives, which kind of brings us up to date from my athletic background to what I have done for the last 40 years.
So why was it important for you to have the word peaceful in there?
Well, because there are many people who are true warriors, like American gladiators, like professional athletes, boxers, soldiers, police. They're on the front lines. They're dealing with combat, in a sense, real or simulated. But not too many of those folks have a peaceful heart. And there are also peacemakers. We classically know nourishing, supportive, loving, the saints, the sages. But not that many of them have a warrior spirit. So when I use the term peaceful warrior, it really describes all of us. It's not just my way. Many people resonate with the term because they intuit, they sense that they are a peaceful warrior in training. We're striving to live with a peaceful heart, but at the same time, in everyday life, not just in combat situations, there are times we need a warrior's spirit. And so that balance, the peaceful balance is the term warrior. And that's what I mean by it.
Got it. So how do people go about taking the teachings today and learn to have more of both ethos, the peaceful and the warriors. What do you recommend, like if some of the people listening to this, the gladiators right now, yeah. simple steps that they can do to improve their life a little bit?
Sure. Well, there was a fundamental, there are a couple of shifts people sometimes go through. When they experience success, as you have, as I did in the sports arena, and we realize, you know, it doesn't exactly do it. It's not lasting. We have moments of elation in the zone, you know, in the flow and all that. But it doesn't deeply impact, like, now I've arrived. There's always another meet, another competition, another way to prove ourselves. But I started asking, you know, where is it? Where is this sense of satisfaction? So I kind of shifted from the Western solution to happiness, achievement, unleashing your power, all that, you know, stuff. And I said, maybe that's not really the answer. And I started looking for the Eastern solution to happiness, which is more the opposite, the peaceful part, more introspective, meditation, inner work, and leading to some sense of illumination, not taking life or ourselves quite so seriously, learning to navigate and transcend. You see, it's not so much about self-improvement, but about self-transcendence. And again, it's the way, the analogy I use is many of us are down in the weeds at the base of a mountain, and we're looking at maybe some blue bugs fighting over a crumb, and we're focused in on the little things, the details of daily life, which we need to. But suddenly we find ourselves up on the mountaintop, and we're looking at this vast panorama. It's so beautiful because everything looks better in the distance. And that bigger picture, that panoramic view, is what I describe as a spiritual vision, where we see things in perspective, and perspective is the better part of wisdom. So we gain that sense of, ah, it's going to be okay. This too shall pass. These bigger picture ideas, the universal laws we learn to follow, rather than tunnel vision and nose down, you know, going for it. Because when we get, you know, Ram Dass said it beautifully once. He said, you know, the Buddha once said life is suffering, or dissatisfaction is what he meant. So if you don't get what you want, there's a kind of dissatisfaction or suffering involved. And if you get what you really don't want, which we've all done at times, that is a form of suffering or dissatisfaction. And even if we get exactly what we want, it's still there's some dissatisfaction, because we can't be guaranteed to hold on to anything indefinitely. So that's bigger picture stuff that reminds us of what is life really, what are we here for to do? And some of my books deal with that. They deal a lot with life purpose. There's a book called The Life You Were Born to Live, which many people find kind of uncanny. And other books, No Ordinary Moments and so on, that talk about core teaching elements. Because if I could give a slogan or bumper sticker, I wouldn't have written 17 books. They're each very different books. They don't overlap one another very much at all. And they each deal with a different facet of what I call a peaceful warrior's way. But the key is daily life is our arena. It's not an ashram, or, and this moment is where it's all happening. This moment of reality, this moment of sanity. All the rest we call past and future don't exist. What I mean by that is what we call the past, whether it's a few seconds ago or 20 years ago, the past is a set of memory. It's a set of impulses in our brain we call memory. But it doesn't actually exist. We might say, look, I have a picture of my last birthday. I know it exists. No, all that's happening is we're showing a picture in this moment. That it indicates a memory we have. And what we call about the future is just our imagination. It's always the future. All we really have and our moment of power is right now. As athletes, we know that it doesn't matter who wins the warm-up. What matters is what we do in the moment of truth. When the chips are down, what do we bring to our game? And that's the game of everyday life as well. It's like, life is a game we play as if it matters.
That's profound. You said something about self-transcendence. Can you talk a little bit more of that, instead of self-improvement, self-transcendence, and the difference?
Sure. self-improvement, you know, and I was really into it. Speed reading, martial arts, gymnastics, juggling, magic, memory courses. I was so much into self-improvement as a young man. And one day I realized no matter how much I improved myself, only one person benefited. And that person someday was going to die, live a life and die. And I could have all these achievements and skills. But how about interconnectedness with people and maybe with life, maybe with what drives some people and calls them into religious or spiritual practice? Because that's really a calling us to our highest ideals, that there may be a bigger picture here. And so the same thing that inspires people who are Christians, Jews, Muslims, whatever, also can inspire people who do meditation and do spiritual practices. I think you'll appreciate this, though. When I teach meditation, I'm going to take, before I get to the point about teaching meditation, when I was coaching gymnastics at Stanford, I had a Zen emphasis. I talked about the meaning of what we were doing, and it wasn't a study break. Gymnastics was a profound form of study, reaching the body, the mind, the emotions, where in classes, academic classes, it's all about just the mind and memory and intellectual capacities. But the whole body happens in gymnastics or any sports training. So anyway, I started getting a reputation as a little bit of an outlier, a little bit of an oddball coach, even though I was quite successful. We had the top U.S. Olympian, for example, on our team. At that point, a coach from USC came up, brought his team up, and he said, "Dan," he whispered to me, you know, before the meet started, I heard rumors that you have your athletes meditate for competitions." And remember, back then in the 70s, that was pretty strange.
Well, you were at Berkeley, so it fit. Or you were at Stanford,
I was at Stanford at the time, from Berkeley. And I told him, I said, "No, of course not. I don't have them meditate before competitions. I have them meditate during competition."
Oh, nice.
And I'm sure he got that later on. Sometime down the line, a light bulb may have gone on. Because gymnastics is a form of meditation. Football is a form of meditation. Whatever we do physically brings our full attention to the moment. And the thing about meditation, it's an exercise. It's not that different from push-ups, another kind of exercise. And if we do push-ups over time, predictably, we get stronger in various muscle groups. And if we meditate over time, we get some distance, some mental distance from the thoughts. We're not so at their affect. They don't impact us as deeply. Thoughts come, thoughts go. And we get more of a sense of equanimity and serenity because we have that distance from our thoughts. We allow them to arise and pass. The primary difference between meditation and push-ups is you can't pretend to do push-ups.
Hmm.
In other words, a lot of people just sit and daydream. They're meditating, but they're really not. So again, these are all exercises, but some of them are more internal and some of them more external. So that gives kind of a flavor. It's not the central core, but the idea of living in the present, focusing on the present moment, what's in front of us, and the value of that, and getting a perspective about where is happiness. You know, the best thing about going to college is we find out it doesn't make us happy. There are people who never went to college who they go for years saying, "If only I'd gone to college, I'd be happy. If only I found my soulmate, I'd be happy, or improved my relationship. If only I had children, I'd be happy. If only I hadn't had children, I'd be happy. If only I made more money, I'd be happy. If only I had more respect, I'd be happy. If only I retired, I'd be happy." Until they realize that there is no such thing as future happiness, because it's always in the future. We're either happy now or we're not. And this idea of happiness, many people misunderstand it. It's not just a good feeling, because they come and go. We know that. An ice cream cone can make us happy for a little while. But this fundamental sense of fulfillment and satisfaction and profound connection with life, that's different. And that's what leads people into the self-transcendence part, not just building up the self more and more and more. Notice I don't use the word ego, because that's been misunderstood. In ancient times, if someone misbehaved, they said, "The devil made me do it." But today we say the ego made me do it. The ego gets a bad rap in spiritual circles. If someone says you have a huge ego, it's not normally considered a compliment. But the ego is simply our sense of identity. It's an organizing principle. You know, I call myself Dan Millman. I don't take this character that seriously anymore, but yes, that's my identity. And you have to have a strong ego before you can transcend it through insight and humor. So it's not about getting rid of the ego. It's just our sense of identity. That's all it is, the conscious self. It's here to learn about life, and that's its usefulness. But we're more than that. And some of my teachings go into three selves that actually are part of the human being in various books of mine and so on. So there's a lot to it, and I don't want to wander off, but I hope that responded to this question about the transcendence part.
I think there was a lot of nuggets in there.
Yeah.
A lot of nuggets about all aspects of life, not only transcendence. But it sounded like, if I understood it correctly, the core was taking control of your mind, not control of your mind, but taking control of your thoughts by sitting down through meditation as the gateway to finding fundamental fulfillment, which leads to transcendence. Not to chase just the happy moments, but to chase the deeper moments on a fulfillment sense, right? So for me, meditation, it's been such an interesting journey. And when I was 14 years old, I started with self-hypnosis to be a better athlete.
I did too.
Yeah. So, and it was like tremendous. Psycho-Cybernetics, Maxwell Maltz was the first book I read when I was 14 years old. And it changed my life. Like, oh my God, I've never been successful at anything. But if I imagined at first I was successful, and that's translated into my real life, then your book took me from visualizing about success to finding peace and equanimity, however you say that word. And that's been a journey that I've been on. You know, I'm 56, so I've been on for the last, 35 years. And I want to thank that book for doing that, because again, and I read all three in the series, No Ordinary Moments, Socrates. What? Tell me the three in that.
Well, The Journeys of Socrates. Did you read that one?
Yes. No Ordinary Moments.
Yeah. Well, again, my first books. Anybody can go to my website and look at all the books. You're like,
so. Out of 17, I can't remember which ones came first. But yeah, but you know, I was rereading the Journey of the Peaceful Warrior this morning and last night, and something still clicked at me, which I forgot that I read, and that is how, for athletic people, when the purest times for us of clarity is when we're doing something physical, like you just said. You know, I still love training, Dan, because when I go train, when I go there for that hour, the focus is so pure. Those voices, those noises, the thoughts about the future and the past, they don't exist. I am so in the moment. And I see that with meditation. And you said something about how people cannot fake push-ups, but they can fake meditation. Right? Or pretend they're doing it. So what is the difference between phrasing what you said, pretend meditation, and a more truer sense of meditation that is like push-ups?
Well, push-ups, it's obvious if you're not doing them. But meditation, you can sit down and close your eyes and just daydream. And really, the practice, the essence of meditation, some people call it mindfulness meditation, but it's actually allowing thoughts to be there, not trying to stop them, quiet the mind, just noticing and getting some distance from them. So you simply sit. There's no success. You just sit. When a thought comes up, notice if you're giving it attention. Go back to your mantra or your breathing or various objects of meditation and let it go. Kind of let it go, let it flow. So that's what the essence of meditation is. You notice. And you let it go. A feeling may pass. You may feel an emotion, a physical sensation, a thought, and you let it go. You just notice it. Oh, yeah. And then you go back to your mantra, your breathing, your counting, whatever technique someone uses. They're all fine. Whatever works for different people. But that's essentially what meditation is about. Now, let me give a little refinement to what you said. It's not about controlling the mind. Many people want to control the mind. It's impossible. And I'll tell you why. Because the mind are thoughts, the arising thoughts, random thoughts, call it our discursive mind. the monkey mind. It's not about using our mind and memorizing things and shopping lists and doing tasks. We can do all that. But it's these random thoughts that become moods that just pop up into our mind. We'd like them to be more positive and not negative thoughts. But you know what? There are people who've read many books on positive thinking. And I ask audiences sometimes, and many hands go up. And I say, great. Those of you who've read that those positive thinking books, how many of you have only had positive thoughts for, say, the last week? All the hands go down. And but people believe, but if I'd highlighted everything and read the book twice and done all the exercises, maybe I would then have more positive thoughts and fewer negative ones. Or maybe that's an idealistic notion. Maybe we can learn to look at life in a more positive way, because we look at life through filters, these perceptual filters. Some people see it through rose-colored glasses, others darker glasses. You know, there's a saying, a Serbian proverb, that says, two men looked out of prison bars. One saw mud and the other saw stars. And so both mud and stars exist in our life. But where do we want to attend to? What do we want to focus on? Just the mud or also the stars? So that's our perceptual filters. But as far as controlling the thoughts, we don't have a spam filter in our head. We don't say to ourselves, I think I'll think this thought next. Thoughts happen to us. So good advice, if someone wants to take away something like, what's practical advice here, Dan? It would be to accept our thoughts and feelings, positive or negative, as natural to us in the moment. The second thing is, focus on a purpose, a constructive purpose. What do you want to get done right now? What needs to be done? And the third thing is, do what needs to be done in line with our purpose. So it's not about fixing the mind, fixing our inside so we can finally live. So it's not, the Eastern solution isn't necessarily the answer. It's a combination of East and West, because the only thing we actually have direct control of by our will is how we move our body, how we act, how we behave. And any athlete understands that. How many times did you go to training or workout when you weren't really feeling like it? But you did it because it was in line with your purpose, right?
Even today, Dan.
You know, Jack LaLanne, remember that old fitness guru, Jack LaLanne?
Oh, of course I do.
I worked out with him once doing handstands at Santa Monica Beach. And Jack used to say, I hate to exercise, but I love the results. So he just did it. And so there's there's an approach to life that just do it approach, because life always comes down to that. It simplifies life. Because, you know, there's that old saying in the Zen tradition, first mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. But then after you do a lot of spiritual work, mountains are no longer just mountains and rivers are no longer just rivers. But finally, at the end of the journey, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. So the point is, it can get complicated for a while. How do I stop my thoughts and work with them to make my thoughts better so I can feel more positive emotions and finally I can do what I need to do? There's an approach that simplifies all of it. Focus on what you do, because if you look at your life, my life, anyone's life, they're shaped primarily by what we do over time. And that's why I suggest to people is we can't control the outcomes in life. No one can guarantee success through any system or method, but we can control our efforts. And by making a good effort over time, we vastly increase the odds of getting our desired goals over not making the effort. So, and you know this, any athlete is going to go, yeah, I mean, I know this from my experience, but many people don't know this. They haven't done the push-ups. They haven't done the training, the real stuff. And so that's why, see, my spiritual training didn't start after college or after teaching. My spiritual training started when I was about 11 years old on the trampoline. It started in gymnastics. Anybody who's been an athlete is doing spiritual training. They just don't recognize it. They're learning great wisdom, but if they're so focused on the points, the scores, the wins, the losses, they miss the point of the internal changes that are happening.
I get that. You used a term, a slogan from Nike, just do it creates the results.
Sure.
But for people who are stuck, for people who can't get themselves to just do it, what do you recommend to help them push forward?
Yeah, that's a very fair question. But that belief we still come up against. Now, it's true that some people need a process before they're ready to just do it. And yet, it can be an endless process of how do I motivate myself to make the commitment, to have the discipline to do what I need to do? There are people who go through 12-step programs, which is a wonderful spiritual school, actually, you know, the AA program and so on. And they go through 12 steps. Of course, I joke about high achievers have to do 24 steps, you know. 12 just isn't enough.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's always going to come down to what will I do in this moment? And once that clicks, once people realize, in fact, I think I can find something here that, here it is. Here it is. Let me put my glasses on here to read this. Listen to this. To progress toward your goals, please choose one of the two following methods. You can find a way to quiet your mind, create empowering beliefs, raise your self-esteem, and practice positive self-talk to find your focus, affirm your power, and free your emotions to visualize positive outcomes so that you can develop the confidence to generate the courage, to find the determination, to make the commitment, to feel sufficiently motivated to do whatever it is you need to do. That's very popular approach. All those complicated, fascinating techniques we can do. And the second method, which I recommend, is you can just do it. Because life is always going to come down to what will you do now? And that's it. So yeah, I can sit there. Wait, look, when we were in our junior or senior year as athletes, the coach had this idea and he put a picture window in the wall between the hallway and our workout room. So a lot of people walking by, including co-eds, would stop and watch us. And it was like the old days at the beach when we were performing. Suddenly we lost all fear of death. We were soaring higher. We were stronger because we had an audience. And the following year we won the NCAA championships. So that's
interesting.
That motivated us. So the coach exerted some leverage. So there are tricks, there are techniques to help us ourselves be motivated. The more meaningful something is to us, which is how I developed the team at Stanford, I made it more meaningful to train in gymnastics as a profound form of study that could change their lives rather than just, oh, I'm going to take a study break and go into the gym and work out. So in making it more meaningful, that made it more motivating for them to want to come in and do the work, because they saw were more invested in it. So yeah, there are things we can do to motivate ourselves, but it still will come down to, again, you can go get psychoanalyzed. You can go get six coaches telling you different things, but it always comes down to, you know, when you were going to train, you go in and you do your best each day, and that may be different each day. Some days are better than others. And that's true in everyday life as well. I mean, I still mess up. People ask me, Dan, you teach these 12 gateways to personal growth, personal development. Have you mastered all these gateways? My answer is a clear no. I have not mastered every, but I'm practicing sincerely. And if you watch me over time, you'd probably find me a good example. Perfect example? No. But, you know, Albert Schweitzer once said, in influencing other people, example is not the main thing. It's the only thing.
Oh, no, I like that. So who would be the number one person besides yourself that will tell you that you're not living up to the 12 principles? I know in my household, because I coach as well, it's my significant other.
You know? Absolutely. Absolutely.
You do all this with other people, but you're not following your own principles. Does that happen in your household once in a while?
Oh, sure. It's universal. A lot of guys or gals, you know, either one, they're out in the workaday world and they can define success at their work. But at home, we're always failures. At home, I mean, I was introduced as a mindfulness expert in Melbourne, Australia, when I gave a talk there some years ago. And the first thing I said was, my wife would beg to differ. After I wash the dishes, she'll say, Dan, you left two spots here. You have to be more careful. So, and my daughters, oh my goodness. You know, I tell people when my daughters were teenagers, we got along incredibly well, unless I said something really kind of insensitive or stupid, like, hello. Anybody with funny. Kids understands that. So again, we all do our best, and you have to recognize that our parents did the best they could in raising us, whether they were kind and attentive and sophisticated, or whether they were paid no attention to us or were even cruel at times. They were doing the best they knew how within the wounds they had, within their limitations. We all have different limits.
Right.
And so we all, by definition, do the best we can.
Yeah, when you get one of those little like taps on the shoulder from your daughters or from your wife, you know, how do you deal with that, process that?
Well, I try to listen not so much to how the message is delivered, but the essence of it. And I always look to, is there some truth in this? And rather than being defensive, look, this happened some time ago, but it was just a moment. My wife was, you know, it took me 25 years to realize my wife was not criticizing me. She was improving me.
Yeah, and that's key right there, Dan. No, that right there is key, because so many times we hear it as criticize them, mm-hmm. and we don't hear the intention behind it. I love that little reframing right there you did. Yeah. She's trying to help me improve.
Sometimes enthusiastically. And if she's in one of those times when she's improving me enthusiastically, sometimes I'll do the typical guy thing, which is to kind of break off eye contact, cross my arms, look away, and act basically like an adolescent. And while I'm doing that, she's talking, and I go, are you done yet? You know, other times, though, I have risen to the occasion. And I've said, you know, I appreciate your sharing that, taking the time to do that. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Oh, wow.
I've actually done that and listened and taken it in. And that's not easy. It's the hardest thing. We're more vulnerable to people we care about. So these are the challenges of everyday life. Relationships is a primary challenge in everyday life, but you learn a lot about yourself, as anybody who's been married over time knows, and children, raising kids. These are all ways we do kind of daily life is a form of spiritual weight training. You don't lift any weights, you don't get any stronger.
Yeah, and I've been fortunate. I mean, my oldest son is 33 years old. I just had one. And then the last few years, the significant other in my life, she has a son who's now 9. So I'm getting to see parenthood again with a 25-year window. And it's just like, wow. Part of me, you know, I have to work on letting go of the guilt for not knowing these things and beating myself for not knowing these things when I had my kid when I was 22, my first son.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, I was 21. Yeah, when I
had. If I had this wisdom. But, my son Tyler, he turned out fantastic. We're going to dinner tomorrow night. We get along fabulously. It was a tough journey through the teenage years, I think, as a lot of parents can attest to. Yeah. But it's going good. And now I'm getting to see it again and seeing the opportunity and chance as a parent, step-parent, that you really have and how valuable it is to step into that and to breathe in that and to spend time with that child. I see so many of my successful friends in their 40s who are so buried about work. And I just like, you know what? You're going to regret this, because as he gets older or she gets older, as your kid gets older, their memory of you is going to be, oh yeah, dad was always working. Oh yeah, mom was always working. They're kind of too busy for me. And that's not the memory you want to have. I want to switch to another gear for you.
Sure.
Do you have a favorite failure of yours? Has there been a failure or a parent failure of yours that later set you up for success?
Well, when I was in the gym, I failed 50 times a day, trying new moves, crashing. So for me, failure wasn't really a meaningful word. It was just a stepping stone to eventually succeeding. And I'll tell you a true story. When I turned 50, I took an all-night hike. I wanted to do something special, you know, on that birthday, a solo hike through the mountains. But when I was 60, when I hit 60, then I wanted to do something else special. And I was going to try to sneak up the Golden Gate Bridge to the top wearing all black. But this was after 9/11, and my wife said, over my dead body. So she kind of deep-sixed that idea. But instead, I said, well, wait a minute. Maybe I'll learn to ride a unicycle. And so for my 60th birthday, a friend of mine loaned me his unicycle, set it up for me. And he said, practice in a tennis court near your house. It's level ground and you can get a death grip on the chain link fence. You know, as you, cause it's very humbling. Anybody who's tried to ride one of those things knows it feels impossible. You get on and whoop, it goes out from under you. You get on, goes out from under you. Well, make the story short. I worked it. I came back every morning and worked on it. And it felt like very little progress. I could maybe do 6 pedals before it went down, you know, the first week, second week, maybe 12, but something clicked. At the end of the third week, I was doing figure eights around the tennis court. So oh, wow. Yeah, I could do it. Now I learned 2 valuable things from training on the unicycle. One, I learned that everything is difficult until it becomes easy. Mm. And I'm talking about, parenting, sports, whatever it is, anything new is difficult until it becomes easy. Sometimes at my trainings, I'll teach juggling and not just scarves. I'm talking about real juggling. And people get very disoriented. How do I do this? It just doesn't feel right. But then they learn it. So there's a process. But the second lesson, and I know we've all experienced this, even learning to drive a gear shift car, we've experienced it, those who have done that, is I learned that there were days where everything fell apart. There were days where nothing seemed to work. I was worse than I was 3 days before. Can you relate to that at times in practice?
Oh, yes.
But I also noticed that the day after those so-called bad days, I usually made a breakthrough and like a jump in the learning process because the learning was actually happening, going from the front brain to the back brain on those days. That seemed everything was falling apart and confused, physical confusion, mental confusion. But if I just persisted, I usually had a breakthrough soon after. And that was, you know, I'd learned that in gymnastics years before, but it was good relearning it at 60 years old.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. So how old are you now, Dan?
I'll turn 75 in February.
Get out of here.
Yeah,
we look
yeah.
the same age. I mean, my hair is a little darker, but you look fantastic, man. Well, it's thanks. Amazing how you've been able to keep this youth and this vitality. And wow, that's you give me inspiration. You give me hope that this Dan can look like that Dan in 20 years from now. So let me ask you this. Your journey with Socrates the first time happened when you were in college. So for me, just go along this journey with me. You're your age now, and you go back and you talk to Dan at 55. And the reason I'm using 55, because I'm 56.
Yeah.
So what have you learned in the last 20 years that you will go back and tell Dan Millman at 55 or Dan Nitro Clark at 55? What are the lessons that the Socrates in you would teach or share with your 55-year-old self?
Well, I think drawing 50 lessons, I would summarize it as the importance of trusting oneself and trusting your own process. That's if I were talking to my younger self or anyone younger, I would say I've learned incredible techniques. And I've studied with a guru whose presence kind of knocked you out. And in my book I'm working on now, I talk about 4 significant mentors in my life who influenced my life and work. So there are innumerable lessons. But this idea of trusting our process, you know, someone once said, I cannot write a book commensurate to Shakespeare, but I can write a book by me. Comparison is a form of suffering. Because as soon as we compare ourselves to someone else, whether we think we're better or not as good as, we're disrespecting our own process. When I used to teach somersaults, Dan, I noticed some people learn them more quickly than others. But those people who took longer to learn often learned it better than those who learned it quicker. So we need to trust our own way of learning, our own way of being, our own life experience. It's never going to go perfectly smooth. Again, that idea of spiritual weightlifting, the adversities we face, the difficulties, the challenges are what develop that spiritual muscle, so to speak.
How do we learn to trust, though?
Yeah. How do we learn to trust?
How do we learn to trust?
We learn when we don't trust, we learn the consequences of that. You know, there is a higher principle that says There may be no ultimate right and wrong, as ideas of morality have gone only so far. There's still a lot of people in prison, whether or not they knew what was right or wrong. But we you know what we do learn from is consequences. When we behave in a certain way, when we act, we get a lesson from that. You know, lessons repeat themselves until we learn them. You notice that one? I certainly have. And if we don't learn easier lessons, they get more dramatic. So, and that's true in every arena of life. We're learning that today. We have special challenges today, and it makes us stronger. It's going to do that. It can't not do that. Life develops what it demands. And when the demands are increased, as we know in sport, progressive training, we learn more. We develop more. And so daily life is our school. Earth is a school, and daily life is our classroom. And in one of my books called Everyday Enlightenment, I go into the 12 courses we have to pass in order to become fully human and preparing us for spiritual wisdom.
Right.
But we have to be prepared first. So again, you asked me for kind of one summary thing, and it's about not comparing ourselves to other people, but it's about trusting our own process. And yes, we do our best every day by definition. Some days are better than others.
Yeah,
and that carries us through in work, in relationships, at home, in everything we do.
Yeah, I often say comparison is a thief of joy. Because when we compare, at least when I compare, I don't compare myself to someone who's at my level. I find my richest friend who's the most successful, and I compare my business acumen to him.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
I find the three guys in the world who are better at, you know, rowing than me or CrossFit than me, and I compare myself to them. Oh, I'm falling short. I'm falling short. I find the rippedest, leanest guy at 55, you know, who's, you know, shredded, and I go, oh gosh, why am I overweight? So that yeah. And just lately I've been really, really, and I got this from your website too. I've been really focusing on making that switch into service. And I think that's something that for me, Dan, and I know you've been in service, you know, for so many years now teaching. It's an interesting process, because for so many years it's been about me. You know, what can I do? Look at me. You know, I'm the sports. I'm on TV. I'm here. And I followed that path for so many years. Look at me. I got this big house. Look at me. Look at me. Look at me. I got these cars. Look at me. And just in the last 5, 7, 8 years, it's really come about to being in service. You know, how can I help? You know, how many people can I help transform? How many people can I help through things that I've already been through? And you've been doing this for a long time. Do you have any advice for me as I fully step into that?
Well, you know, that was the second part that I started before, when I said, no matter how much I improve myself, only one person benefited. But it also struck me at the same time, if I could influence the lives of others in a more positive way, which is your calling as well, then that made my life more meaningful. It made it worth something more if I could touch other lives. And, you know, that's why the most spiritual film I've ever seen, one of my favorite films, is Groundhog Day. You remember that, Bill Murray? And people think it's just a rom-com, but actually there are religious leaders who've all said that's our film. Because this guy, you know, he's selfish, he's exploitive, he lives the same day over and over. Some students of the film have said for 1,000 years, the same day over and over and over. And finally, you know, he tries to kill himself 60 times, 100 times, nothing works. He wakes up the next morning and finally he starts educating himself and learning medicine and this and that, how to play the piano. But ultimately, what it ends up, the only game in town at the very end is service. And by the way, it's not a matter of success or service. We can make good money doing what we're suited for, what we enjoy, while serving other people. That's the ideal. I mean, that's my vocational guidance for anybody. Find a way to make what feels like good money to you, doing what you basically enjoy or are suitable for, and do it while serving other people in humble ways, whatever form that takes. And that's practical stuff.
No, I like that. So last question for you is, you project forward 25, 30 years now, at the end of your days, what mark will you have want to have left, or what would you want people to say about you and your time here on this planet?
I like that, an existential question. And that meditation that you're studying that I put online, it'll get you even deeper into that. You'll see, since you just started it and there's more steps. But what I would like to be remembered by, very simple things. You know, I sometimes tell people my highest aspiration on death is to become really good compost. But that's true, but it's also a frivolous answer. What I'd like to, you know, I feel like I've left behind with this new book, The 18th, I'm probably going to retire from long form writing. That feels like enough. And so that is my heritage, I think. I hope that it will continue to serve the lives of others. And of course, whatever impact I've had in my family as an example will also be lasting.
But yeah, I think you've laid your legacy through your 17 books.
I really have. So it's not like something I still have to do, though I would like to finish this book. and you know, it's funny.
Hey, Dan, just do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Just do it.
And that's what I'm doing. I'm just doing it every day. So I try to be a good example. Alden Nolan said, children have never been very good at listening to what their parents tell them, but they never fail to imitate them.
Yes, so, I love that.
Yeah. So again, that's the example part.
That's example. So just why I have you on here, I started your 4-minute meditation practice the first day. I went to your website. Tell me your website while I have you here.
Yeah, the website is peacefulwarrior.com.
Yeah,
or it can be danmillman.com. It'll go to the same place.
Right. And then you see this prolific amount of work that you've done, all this goodness that you put out into the world. And I want to take time to thank you for that, to thank you for being a transformative figure in my life, to thank you for, you know, being a mentor. You really have been a mentor for a period of my life, and it really put me on a new path. And I feel so lucky, and I feel so grateful that, you know, 25 years later, 20 years later, through the podcast. And this is the reason, Dan Millman, that I did the podcast, so I could sit in the room with guys like you who I looked up to, who I loved their work, who had changed my life. So I want to thank you for all the good work that you've put out into the world, how you've affected my life personally, and thank you for your time graciously that you've spent for coming on the Gladiator Way.
Well, I appreciate that, Dan, and I appreciate you and the work you're doing to help people like me to reach out and touch the lives of others. So it's all working.
I hope you enjoyed the show with Dan Millman. And again, I go out and go to his website, go look at his the book, The Journey of the Peaceful Warrior, No Ordinary Moments. These books, again, were such stepping stones for me and was the pathway for me and my spiritual growth as a human being and a man. And I think if you take the time to go look for them and go to his website and check out the 4-minute meditation, check out the 4-minute workout, and you can find them at danmillman.com or thepeacefulwarrior.com, and also put them in the show notes. Once again, I want to thank you for joining me on the Gladiator Way. Go out today, lift somebody up, change the world by changing one person. Go out, commit, crush, conquer. Live your life, not only the peaceful warrior way, but the gladiator way. And again, thanks, and subscribe and share with a friend.